Welcome to this Forthright Radio for November 18th, 2020. I'm Joy LaClaire. We have a very full show for you today. With us for the hour is award-winning journalist, author, former senior associate in the Democracy and Rule of Law program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and special advisor to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Sarah Chase. Her latest book on corruption in America and what is at stake is published by Knopf. Her fluency in French, Arabic, and Pashto not only allowed her to be an NPR reporter in Paris, North Africa, and the Balkans from 1996 to 2002. In 2002, she left reporting to contribute to rebuilding that country. She arrived in Kandahar 2 days after the fall of the Taliban and lived there till 2009, where she helped establish the Argonne Cooperative in 2005 and became intimately acquainted with kleptocracy. In 2010, Sarah Chase became a special advisor to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Admiral Mike Mullen. In this capacity, she contributed to strategic U.S. policy on Afghanistan, Pakistan, and the Arab Spring. Her previous books include The Punishment of Virtue, Inside Afghanistan After the Taliban, and Thieves of State, Why Corruption Threatens Global Security. We welcome you to Forthright Radio, Sarah Chase. Thank you for joining us today.
Joy, thanks so much for having me.
Well, let's get to work. There is so much in your book on corruption in America and what is at stake. To begin with, when you speak of corruption, what do you mean?
It's so interesting. When I was talking about corruption from the perspective of Afghanistan, I often heard, well, that's really just part of the culture over there. And what was really interesting is I only got that reaction from Westerners. I never, in all the years I worked on corruption, either in Afghanistan when I was living there or afterwards, when I tried to draw some of the lessons from that experience to see whether they applied to other developing countries, I never heard from Afghans or Tunisians or Nepalese or Nigerians, oh, Sarah, would you get off your corruption soapbox? This is just how we do things. But what I would like to say, so residents of all of those countries that I've worked in have a very clear idea of what corruption is. They often tell you a story to define it rather than giving you a dictionary definition. Things like, he gets all the development resources and then he surrounds himself with armed thugs so we can't come to him to lodge our grievances. That's corruption. Things like that. And so that's a kind of interesting sentence. And it leads to the real distinction I want to make here. I'm not talking about a specific instance by a specific isolated venal official who essentially does a one-to-one transaction, some money for something he or she does or doesn't do. That's how corruption is defined under U.S. law, and it's defined so narrowly that you practically have to sign a contract at this point in order for you to be prosecutable for corruption. What I'm talking about is much similar to what the Afghans were describing to me and what I saw, which is to say networks of people who weave back and forth across sectors of our society that we tend to think of as being separate. Like the network includes top businessmen and government officials, and they swap places. And it may even include outright criminals, drug runners or traffickers of various things. It may even include, I want to say, violent gangs or thugs, if you will, people who can commit violence on behalf of the network and yet be plausibly deniable. The networks are also often vertically integrated. And what that means is when people lower down on the totem pole benefit from the corrupt system, well, they kick some of the proceeds up the line. And I would see that in developing countries where the sort of street level corruption is much more in your face than it is in the United States, where policemen who might stop your car and invent some violation and then shake you down for whatever the equivalent of a couple dollars. Well, they don't get to keep all that money. They kick some of it up the line. It goes all the way to the interior minister in the capital. In a country like Afghanistan, and my numbers are out of date, but back in about 2010, there were two different bribery surveys. And if you sort of look at the numbers that they come out with, the total of this kind of extorted bribe added up in Afghanistan to something between $2 and $5 billion a year. It's a gigantic amount of money. Or you might see things like, to use the Trump administration as an example, although I don't think it is the only example of corruption in the United States at the moment, it is a little bit of an exaggerated example, when you have government officials deliberately holding their functions or even personal functions in Trump properties. That's another way that, or sending troops, detouring them in order to stay in Scotland in a Trump property. That's some of the ways that subordinates kick benefits up the line.
Well, as I mentioned in the introduction, you lived in Kandahar from 2002 to 2009, and you were working with men and women in a cooperative soap-making enterprise. And of the 20 with whom you work, you write that they represented 9 different tribes and ethnic groups, and 10 if you include yourself.
Yeah.
Now, they told you it wasn't religious fanaticism that was driving their friends and cousins into the arms of the Taliban. What did they say was the reason?
Corruption. Absolutely corruption. I mean, let me just go back. This is Kandahar, Afghanistan. These are religiously conservative people. They are practicing Muslims, all of them. We broke for prayers. The women wore head coverings inside the cooperative, but they did not cover their faces. So that was kind of interesting. You had males and females not from the same family who were uncovered, but they are religiously observant people. However, they did not like the Taliban form of kind of imposed strictures, and they did not have a problem with Western culture. They understood that different people have different cultures. Their problem was, and their neighbors' problems, and their relatives' problem was, the abusive corruption of the government that the United States was supporting. And that meant that basically every single time you came into contact with a government official, you had to cough up some money. And this is important, it wasn't just a matter of money. If a police officer had stood out in the middle of the road and stopped a passing motorist and said, look it, my salary is ridiculously low and I'm on the front lines here and I have a daughter who needs shoes, could you help out a little bit? I mean, people would take the shoes off their own daughters to give it to someone who said that. Instead, what happens is you're shaken down in a very contemptuous and humiliating way. And when you're poor and proud, I mean, that's a wound. All you have left is your dignity. And I remember I had a former police officer in my cooperative. And one time his brother got mistreated in this way. And my cooperative member was so furious that he said, by God, if tomorrow I see somebody planting an explosive in the road and I see a police vehicle driving down that road, I'm not going to say anything. Now, I don't know if that's actually literally true, but the idea that a former police officer is telling me, an American, that in effect he would collude with Taliban, for me, that just said it all. And I saw the same thing. I talked to people who had kind of rooted for Boko Haram in northern Nigeria. Now, these were not radical Islamist people. These are, again, observant Muslims. These were people who had done advanced degrees in the United States, and they were in contracting, or one was a movie maker, one owned a small hotel. These were very highly educated, not at all extremist individuals, but they were so beside themselves at the corruption. And interestingly, there as here, often where the rubber hits the road is with the police. And early on, Boko Haram was only going after the police. And so these people said in the first early months, we were for them. We were for them. And then as things start to spin off into a more and more extreme direction, people often regret it. But in the case of the Taliban, I mean, again, basically, I want to say friends of mine who were opposed to the Taliban's project for their country found themselves obliged to take disputes to Taliban justice because the government justice sector was so unbelievably corrupt that you just did not have any opportunity to get, let's say, substantively based solution. It was just whoever could pay the most for the decision would get the decision in their direction.
Okay, one more question about Afghanistan. Troop withdrawals were announced yesterday affecting Afghanistan from 4,500 down to 2,500. The New York Times reported today, quote, "If it were not for the air support of U.S. forces, the Taliban would be sitting inside Kandahar City now," end of the quote. Colonel Zabihullah Gorzang, an Afghan Army regimental commander in Kandahar province, said Tuesday. I wonder briefly what your thoughts are on this.
It's really hard for me to answer this question briefly. I actually don't answer current Afghanistan questions anymore because, look, once
okay,
we
can leave, Sarah, well, we can leave it at that if you want.
Well, let me just put it this way.
All right.
Once the United States decided that it was not going to address the systemic corruption of the Afghan government, that it was not going to cease enabling and reinforcing that systemic corruption on its own, then the project, as stated, the U.S. or international project in Afghanistan, as stated, was destined to lose. It was destined to fail. Afghans don't need air support. You know what I mean? Like, the Taliban don't have air support. So it's not a matter of military prowess. It's a matter of, are you supporting a government that Afghan citizens can be proud of? And if they can be proud of their government, they're Afghans too, and the other side is Afghans. They can fight the Taliban off in a minute. The problem is that if you claim to support the Afghan government, then you get into a negotiation with the Taliban from which you have excluded the Afghan government. You then take away all of the Afghan government's leverage, meaning, number one, the prisoners that were in jail, and number two, U.S. troops. And then you're expecting the Afghan government to be able to negotiate evenly with the Taliban. It's symbolically, I mean, a real knife in the back. And then to announce that you're going to pull troops out further when the Taliban have actually been stepping up their attacks against Afghan civilians, you really are handing the country over to the Taliban. And so while I don't believe in keeping troops there if the United States was not prepared to really conduct its mission properly to help the Afghans build a government that they could be proud of, you know, there's no point in having U.S. troops bear the brunt of that failure. On the other hand, to pull them out now under these circumstances is almost an explicit and deliberate slap in the face to a government that you claim to be allied with.
We're speaking with Sarah Chase. Her latest book is On Corruption in America and What is at Stake. Sarah, your book goes all the way back to our primate ancestry.
Yeah. It's not comprehensive. I just want to tell folks listening, I don't go all, you know, yes, I touch upon our primate ancestors, but believe me, this is not like a chronology of corruption from the first days of speciation of Homo sapiens. I selected a couple of specific moments in prehistory and history to touch upon.
That's true. I will say this, however, it's very thoroughly footnoted, 90 plus pages of endnotes. All right, but you incorporate mythology as metaphor.
Yeah.
And you go into the history of money. Now, I was particularly intrigued by your section on how the Greeks dealt with the innovation of money and that they originated their transfer of wealth in the shape of spits on which meat is cooked. Would you please explain that?
Wow, you have put your finger, Joy, in on the very paradox of money. It's really remarkable. So bear with me a moment while I sort of get at this. The evolutionary side of this that really blew my mind, and this is a theory, obviously it's likely debated and things like that, but a number of primatologists and anthropologists have been working on the issue of how did we get our conscience? How did we get our moral system as a species? And a number of folks, and one of the, I found the clearest, is a man named Christopher Bohm, who is both a primatologist and an anthropologist, on the origins of egalitarianism. And it looks like that is one of the things that makes us human. It's a social revolution that we kind of pulled on the primate order. With very few exceptions, primates are hierarchical. They have some egalitarian tendencies that could be built upon, but it looks like humans, until agriculture, were almost entirely egalitarian. And so Bohm wondered, and that's like 150,000 years. That's a really long time. And Bohm is trying to figure out why and how did we do it? And what he comes up with is that it had to do with meat eating. And that's another thing that helped us, or that also helped us develop our large brains, which is another thing that apparently makes us human. You sometimes wonder. But, and the point is that while our closest cousins, chimpanzees, eat meat occasionally, it's not a staple. And therefore, it is a very hierarchical thing. Whoever hunts the game, it's the alpha male who gets the carcass and then doles out a little bit, a few scraps to his, if you will, ruling elite coalition, right? His cronies. Humans started making meat their staple. Now, we're talking big game here. We're talking mastodons. We're talking woolly rhinoceroses. You're not going to, as a lone hunter, bring one of those down alone. Therefore, you're really talking hunting bands. And to survive, if meat is now your staple, you need those bands to hold together, those hunting parties to hold together. So how do you do it? You share the meat equally. It's incredibly important. You share the meat equally. And what Bohm found is when he then started looking at ethnographies of hunter-gatherer tribes is that one of the things that gets you punished by the tribe is if you steal or hoard or snatch or hog more than your share of the meat. So now we come to spits. In ancient Greece, religious festivals always included a sacrifice, an offering of meat animals to the gods. But what's interesting is the gods only got like the entrails. They got a little bit of liver and, you know, some kidneys and stuff like that. Really, what was going on at those sacrifices is the meat was being divided equally among the community. Even though by that time ancient Greece was sedentary and agricultural, still that hunter-gatherer egalitarianism was being reenacted among the community. And isn't it kind of interesting that ancient Greece is where we first start getting democracy in, or the precursor of democracy in complex society? And so the way they were passing the meat around was on spits, which are very ordinary items, right? I mean, they're piece chunks of metal. They're not gold or silver, which is how wealth was stored in Babylon and things like that. These are just ordinary iron spits, but they become a marker for equal value because the meat had to be shared out equally. So you've got five pieces of meat on a spit, and so a spit tends to start to embody in a way that value. And so they started being used as a proto-currency. Spits. And then eventually in Anatolia came the real innovation of money, which is, again, a piece of metal whose trade value is separate from its intrinsic value. That's what's interesting about a spit, is it doesn't matter if one spit weighs a little bit more or a little bit less than another. A spit's a spit's a spit. Just like a dime is a dime is a dime. I mean, we don't weigh out the amount of silver, nickel, and copper in a dime, let alone in the, you know, electronic signals, which is how we now store money. So the irony about money is that when it first appears in a society in quantity, it tends to have a leveling effect. It tends to be connected with democratic tendencies. It tends to be a contrary, it breaks down aristocracy as a sort of elite system. The problem is that once societies start getting constructed around money, then a new aristocracy develops around who has the most of it, or who can hoard it, or who can rig the system so as to channel more of it to them and their networks. And let me just finish this already long answer by referring back to, you mentioned mythology. And it's true. I mean, for a book on current events, it's pretty crazy that I plunge readers back into fairy tales. But the fact is, we can call it mythology or we can call it sacred stories. These stories are deeply true. And I fear that in turning our backs on them and dismissing them as fairy tales or as myths, we're actually missing out on a storehouse of wisdom. And sometimes I fear that we are therefore kind of being forced to live our mythology in the flesh. And that's why I thought it was important to really explore a couple of these stories. So the one I chose to illustrate this issue is the myth of Midas. Remember the guy who, he was a king who did a favor for a god, and in gratitude, the god said, okay, I'll give you one wish, whatever you want. And he says, I want everything I touch to turn to gold. The god was not real happy about that, but had made a promise. And so it was. And Midas is delighted and starts touching things, and they turn to gold, and he's really excited. And then, oh boy, it's lunchtime. So let me sit down and pour some water in my wine and take a sip. And suddenly he realizes he's about to die because he can't eat or drink anything. And Nathaniel Hawthorne retold this story and gave Midas a daughter. And I think that telling really captures the essence of what this myth is about, because he adored his daughter. And when she saw his distress, his sudden distress, she goes running over to comfort him. He bends down to kiss her forehead, and that precious, irreplaceable person, child, is turned into a lump of metal. That's the Midas disease.
Sarah, I'm going to interrupt you there because we're halfway through the program now, and there is so much more I want to talk about.
Right. Yes. Well, let me just, because it, and then we can pivot immediately to...
No, I'm going to summarize.
Okay.
The other myth that you talk about is the myth of the Hydra. And the thing about the Hydra is it's a snake-like monster that has many, many different heads. And the trick with the Hydra is if you remove one of the heads, two more grow back in its place. Hercules was sent, it's one of his 12 labors, was sent to get rid of the Hydra, because you can imagine, he starts bashing the heads, but like I said, it just multiplies them. He required the assistance of his charioteer. When he sliced off a head before two could grow back, the charioteer would sear the wound, and then that prevented the heads from growing back. If you want more detail, Sarah Chase does a beautiful job of extrapolating on that in her book on corruption in America and what is at stake. However, I want to move on to the 19th century. And the Civil War plays a crucial part into the burgeoning of corruption in the United States. You mentioned the role of J.P. Morgan, who got contracts. He bought rifles from the government, which were defective, and then sold them back to the government, killing untold numbers of Union troops because of their defectiveness. And I was particularly impressed with what you excerpted of Abraham Lincoln's first State of the Union address. It's so prescient. I got shivers. I wonder if you would share with us that excerpt.
Yes, I will, but not yet. Okay. Not yet. Because I wasn't going to talk about the Hydra. I wanted to say something really critically important here, which is the point about money is once you make it a yardstick for measuring success, then into a race with no finish line. It's a critically important thing that the Midas myth conveys. There's no such thing as enough. And here's what the myth conveys. You then start converting everything of irreplaceable value, be it the land, on the land, what's under the land, the air, human creativity, human labor, and this will lead us into the Abraham Lincoln quote, human relationships, all of that gets converted into lifeless metal. If you put people infected with the Midas disease in charge of your society, they will start converting everything that matters in that society into zeros in bank accounts. And there's another quote in On Corruption in America that really touches on that. It's Robert Kennedy on gross domestic product. If we judge the United States of America by that, it counts air pollution and cigarette advertising and ambulances to clear our highways of carnage. It counts special locks for our doors and the jails for the people who break them. And he goes on and on and on. And then he says, it measures neither our wit nor our courage, neither our wisdom nor our learning, neither our compassion nor our devotion to our country. It measures everything, in short, except that which makes life worthwhile. So he's really talking about the Midas disease there. I went to the 19th century because I was looking for another time when the Hydra, meaning one of these interlocking networks, corrupt networks that included criminals like J.P. Morgan, as you point out, as well as business people and members of government. When was the last time that the United States was in the grip of this kind of a network as tightly as it is today? And I found the 19th century. And so here is what Abraham Lincoln said. He said that labor is prior to and independent of capital. Now, he is talking in mid-19th century capital labor vocabulary. I'll note that I am not, in this book, talking about capitalism. I'm talking about systemic corruption. And I don't think the two are necessarily identical. So let me just lay that out. Labor is prior to and independent of capital. Capital is only the fruit of labor and could never have existed if labor had not first existed. Labor is the superior of capital and deserves much the higher consideration, the opposite of the way that those two are remunerated in the United States today. Capital gets much higher returns than labor does. Let workers beware of surrendering a political power which they already possess, and which, if surrendered, will surely be used to close the door of advancement against such as they, and to fix new disabilities and burdens upon them till all of liberty shall be lost. In effect, if you surrender your collective power, the system will be rigged against you. And the way that the system has been rigged is through the operation of these coalitions or networks of wealth maximizers. And so I found, as I looked at that 19th century period, I found the parallels with today absolutely extraordinary. It's the same functioning of the same type of networks, in and out, shuttling in and out of government, twisting and bending laws and even constitutional amendments to serve not the purposes for which they were obviously passed, but to serve the purposes of the network instead. And basically hollowing out or crippling any government agencies or institutions that might have actually been defending the citizenry against the corruption of the network. That's exactly what the situation was back there. I would say the differences were the revenue streams were very similar. The revenue streams, which are the same ones I've seen in developing countries all around the world, finance, energy, high-end real estate and construction. And we see those again today, those three in the middle. I think back then, steel and other manufacturing revenue streams played a greater part than they do today. And today, I think you could look at pharma, you could look at industrial agriculture and food, and you could look at tech, obviously, as kind of new, the revenue streams that have been added to the picture.
Now, I'm going to assume that some listeners have heard our shows over the years to talk about a good deal of specifics. But what I want you to do, Sarah Chase, is talk about the end of the 19th century as particularly farmers organized themselves into what became known as the populist movement. And I had always use that perspective for the word populism.
Absolutely. Thank you, Joy.
As opposed to what we think of populism these days, which is highly reactionary. But please talk about what they organized, and especially talk about the issue of the gold standard, because here we are, again, current events. Yesterday, the Senate blocked Judy Shelton's nomination to the Federal Reserve. Among other things, she is a proponent of the gold standard. So please take it from there, Sarah Chase.
Yeah, thank you, Joy. So once I decided, okay, the last time that we were in the grips of kleptocratic networks, if you will, as tightly as we are today, is this period, which I sort of call the Gilded Age, but I actually mean a little bit longer. I mean, literally from at least about 1870 all the way to the New Deal in about 1935. And so then I wanted to see, well, how did we get out of it? How do we get out of it back then? And so I started looking at what some of the resistance movements were at the time. And boy, were there. And they were creative, and they were persistent, and they were courageous, and they were sometimes violent and turbulent, and they were celebratory. I mean, that I was so inspired by these movements. And as you say, perhaps one of the most unexpected one, I had heard of the labor movements, I'd heard of some of the experimental political ideologies that were being developed, but I really didn't know much about the Farmers Alliance. And this is a movement that grew up in what then was the West, which is to say West Texas, and then going northward from there up into Kansas and Missouri and places like that, largely. And it started out as an educational movement. And so you had people driving their covered wagons to the little schoolhouses dozens of miles away once or twice a week to listen to traveling lecturers. And it was a really interesting kind of curriculum that included both farming techniques, but also really sophisticated political and economic thinking, including, as you mentioned, monetary supply. And the understanding that if population is growing and production is growing, but the money supply is fixed, then your debts are in a fixed currency, but you are getting less and less return, monetary return, for crops that you're selling because the quantity of crops is growing. And so farmers were getting screwed, and they were proponents of a flexible money supply. So let me take this back to our original or earlier discussion of Spitz and how when money first makes a large-scale entry into a society, it's democratizing. That's what the farmers were out asking for, is more plentiful money, which has a democratizing effect. Whereas those who are trying to hoard wealth, well, they want a fixed money supply because then every item of currency is going to have higher and higher value as more and more people are trying to get their hands on it, basically. So the Farmers Alliance, which turned into the Popular Party, developed really, really interesting and sophisticated solutions to the problems besetting that you know, were besetting these populations because of the kleptocratic nature of the government. And that included paper currency, it included direct election of senators, it included a really interesting kind of collective mechanism for collective purchase of agricultural inputs, and then collective wholesale sale systems that exist, for example, in French wine country, where you have collective wine cellars that will make bulk purchases of inputs, which can then be at lower prices for all cooperative members. And then cooperative vintners can bring their grapes to the grape cellar, and they will be fermented collectively and marketed collectively so that someone whose talent is raising grapes doesn't have to be basically a small business conglomerate. And so those types of structures and techniques are incredibly successful. And that was kind of the type of thing that the Farmers Alliance was experimenting with and just got completely shut down by these kleptocratic networks. And so the distressing thing that I came out with that emerged with in this exploration of the resistance movements of the time was that while many of their solutions were indeed eventually adopted, including, for example, equal pay for equal work for women, which we're getting close, we're not there yet, but we're a lot closer. That was a demand of some of the unions in the 1870s. It was in the charter of a labor union. So a lot of these solutions have been eventually adopted, not in the lifetime of any of those movements. And that is what I found to be the most sobering realization to emerge from that exploration of that period, which is that it looks to me as though what allowed some of those reforms to take place was the series of utterly devastating worldwide catastrophes that struck in the first half of the 20th century, which is to say the First World War, the Depression, and the Second World War. And that is to recall two world wars, industrialization of warfare, the nuclear bomb, two genocides, a pandemic that puts this one to shame, and a global economic meltdown. And that's really scary. And that, to me, is what the urgency of this book is. We are on almost the same set of railroad tracks that the United States and the world were on in the late 19th and very early 20th centuries. The pattern is almost identical. And the only thing that shook us off it was the kind of solidarity that often emerges in times of great systemic, great, I want to say widespread catastrophe. And as bad as the economic meltdown of 2008 was, and as bad as the current pandemic is, I don't think they're quite reaching the threshold yet. The urgency for me of this effort to curb kleptocracy in this country is that the disasters that lie on the horizon, if we don't, are almost unimaginable.
Are you speaking in large part about catastrophic climate change?
That could be one, certainly, but I don't know. I mean, so we have pandemic, which aligns with the pandemic of 1918. We had 2008, which aligns with the stock market crash of 1929, almost identically, preceded in each case by a couple of years by a terrorist attack on Wall Street. It's really amazing. There was a terrorist attack on Wall Street in 1920, and there was a terrorist attack on Wall Street in 2001 that were explicitly motivated by the same things. As much as we got distracted by the apparent religious covering of Al-Qaeda, as I said before, I discovered there's a lot of anti-corruption driving religious extremism in the world today. So those are parallels that we can say, okay, it was the same thing that happened then, same thing that happened now. We laid the seeds of catastrophic climate or climate change, or I want to go broader and say environmental devastation. We laid those seeds back then in the late 19th century and early 20th centuries. So yeah, there's a parallel there too. Destiny can come up with catastrophes we've never even imagined. Who knows what it could be?
I want to ask you a question that isn't really brought up in your book, but I think you're in a unique position to, among the things you've just mentioned, the pandemic through which we're going, the prospect of the real repercussions of catastrophic climate change, which are happening much sooner than the conservative projections would have led us to believe. At the same time, there is the proliferation of various conspiracy theories that are being cultivated and accepted, well-meaning people. And I don't know why, but among them is this reaction to the United Nations 2030 agenda. Are you familiar with the conspiracy theories around that?
No, I'm not. But well, I love this question. Love this question because we get into some murky waters here. There are some very far out Marvel Comics type conspiracy theories, as you put it, that need to be as clearly and repeatedly debunked as possible. That being said, there are also some conspiracies. Conspiracies do actually exist. And that's kind of what I'm talking about. Now, I'm not saying that there are five people sitting in a room who have planned out exactly who are pedophiles and organizing the entire United States political economy to serve their pedophilia. However, take a look at a book like Dark Money by Jane Meyer or Democracy in Chains by Nancy MacLean, who really show that there was a conspiracy conducted by a sometimes turbulent, sometimes beset by internal rivalries, shifted and dynamic group of the mega rich who, you know, not only delivered us the kind of kleptocratic capture of our politics and economy that we're now looking at, but also things like the reversed views on climate change. That was a deliberate, heavily funded information campaign, which worked. And it was a conspiracy. You know, it was a bunch of people working in secret. The other thing I would like to say, when we're then debunking the Marvel Comics style of conspiracy theorizing, is sometimes a little bit too much contempt is dished out. So let's take quote-unquote anti-vaxxers. We are currently living at a moment when any serious exploration of, for example, the Pfizer vaccine for COVID indicates that there are some real problems with the very rapid rollout of something that presumably is going to be jabbed into millions of people's arms. It is a revolutionary new approach to vaccination. It is therefore ought to be having even stronger and more lengthy controls and testing, but rather is having weaker and shorter ones. It requires an extraordinary cold chain and will be administered now, frankly, by people wearing white coats who not so long ago were telling us that opioid medications were not addictive. The idea that Americans maybe should be skeptical about this, I don't think that's a contemptible conspiracy theory. I know that some of the ways that people are afraid of vaccines are aversion, but I'm skeptical and concerned about the initial rollout of these vaccines. So just more broadly, talking about the sort of what now is getting branded as conspiracy theorizing, I think we have to be just a little bit more nuanced in the thinking about that.
Well, I think that the appeal of these is that average people sense there are conspiracies. They don't know exactly how. And you talk about, since the demise of the Soviet Union, these networks have become globalized. I don't want to go into that. You mentioned that politics and finance have been captured. The judiciary has been captured. Let us end talking about McDonnell versus the U.S., a unanimous decision by the Supreme Court of the United States. Ruth Bader Ginsburg wrote the opinion. We only have about 5 minutes, so take it, please.
She didn't actually write the opinion in that case. She wrote the opinion in a previous case in the series, and Elaine Kagan wrote the opinion in the next case that just was breaking as the book, as On Corruption in America was going to press. So what you raise here, first of all, is back to the Hydra metaphor and these interweaving networks. What's so important, and even the very definition of corruption, what's so important about corruption understood this way is that it's not just about quid pro quo bribery, that I slip you a gift certificate for your favorite restaurant and you're gonna do a really nice review of my book on corruption in America, right? What matters about corruption is these networks who put people, network members in public office, and their role is to bend and twist the instruments of power to serve the network rather than the public. Now, I'm not saying that all of the Supreme Court justices are actively playing that role. However, Lewis Powell, who is an earlier Supreme Court justice, very much was. And if you read On Corruption in America, you'll see what I mean by that. But the case that you mentioned came, the decision came down in the summer of 2016, just as the presidential campaign was heating up. The ex-governor of Virginia, when he had been governor, had accepted a bunch of money and gifts and stuff like that in return for leveraging, trying to get Virginia state government offices to either conduct clinical trials for a kind of quack medicine that his benefactor was hawking, or reimburse it, put it on a state list of reimbursable medications and things like that. The guy is convicted of corruption. That's a unanimous decision of a jury of his peers. The conviction is upheld on appeal unanimously. Supreme Court takes it up. It is overturned, as you said, not just overturned, overturned unanimously. My jaw dropped. And then I'm listening to commentary about it on public radio. And lo and behold, the panel of experts across the political spectrum is also saying, we all agree. We all agree. We think this was the right decision. And the danger of that is the split between how elites do corruption, and beautiful way to end, brings us right to the beginning of our conversation, which is increasingly narrow and legalistic and kind of mincing, and how we ordinary people understand corruption, which is to say the action of these types of networks rigging the system. And the problem is that, as I saw around the world, when there's that kind of a disconnect between the elites who control political and economic power and the ordinary people, then some kind of explosion usually ensues. And so I'd just like to say, you know, we've been talking among On Corruption in America includes many pages of things that regular folks can do to get into this fight, because it's going to take all of us. But it is going to take some changing of laws and enforcement of laws. I mean, Hercules did have to bash off some of the heads of this Hydra in order to kill it. Like, you also have to cauterize the neck, but you do have to bash off some heads. And so while we're thinking about criminal justice reform in this country, I think we have to be really careful to distinguish between non-dangerous nonviolent crime and incredibly dangerous nonviolent crime, like fraud. Fraud handed us the savings and loan crisis. Fraud handed us the meltdown of 2008. Fraud sent 4 million Americans out of their homes into the streets in a homeless crisis. It's an incredibly dangerous nonviolent crime. And so while we're reimagining the police and prosecution in this country, let's beef up the resources that are dedicated to corporate crime and corruption.
30 seconds for final words, Sarah Chase.
Get in the fight. Get in the fight. And it means hold your team, your side, to its own highest standards. The most effective countermove that kleptocratic networks across the around the world use to defeat us, to divide us up along identity divides, and we've started getting really good at spotting corruption on the other side of the political or gender or race or other identity divide. We're not so good at holding our own people up to their highest standards, and we're not going to win so long as the kleptocratic network has the money and has the power at the moment. We've got numbers, but that means we need to bring bear, and that means a cross-cutting egalitarian coalition. Thank you so much, Joy, for having me on this show and for your careful read of On Corruption in America.
Well, Sarah Chase, thank you very much for your work over the many years, and especially bringing us the perspective from your time in Afghanistan, living among Afghani people. You were not like some expat living in a hotel somewhere. Very valuable. It's very, very important. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Joy.
The views and opinions expressed on Forthright Radio are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of this station's staff, its members, board of directors, or contributors. And we have been speaking today on Forthright Radio with Sarah Chase. Her latest book is On Corruption in America and What is at Stake. It's published by Knopf, and there's so much more in it than we were able to get to today. Forthright Radio is a Beyond the Deep End production. Engineer Rich Culbertson, I'm Joy LaClaire, and you can hear past Forthright Radio programs by going to our website, forthright.media.